Uniondale Pueblo Entero versus Abbott. And let's see. Mr. Cole.
Thank you, Judge Smith. May it please the court. Section 208 of the Voting Rights Act ensures that blind, illiterate, and disabled voters enjoy voting assistance from an assister of their choice, not one provided for them by the government, and not any person under any circumstances at any time. The district court's order in this case transforms Section 208's simple promise into a blunt object that would invalidate even the most modest, neutral, or procedural of election laws. The district court erred in holding that Section 208 impliedly preempts six provisions of SB 1, most of which deal with voter assistance, on a theory of obstacle preemption, because those provisions align with, they do not conflict with, Congress's purposes under Section 208.
As I understand it, SB 1 does not do anything to restrict the kinds of persons who can engage in assistance.
That's entirely correct, Judge
Smith. It doesn't do anything to the categories.
It doesn't, no. That's correct. But before we do get into the merits of that, I did, mindful of your admonition at the second argument, start with jurisdiction, since we do have a jurisdictional issue here very briefly. We think that plaintiffs lack Article III standing to challenge these provisions for two reasons, an injury in fact problem and a traceability and redressability problem. The injury problem comes in two flavors. They're asserting associational standing on behalf of their members, and then organizational injuries. I'll turn briefly, if I can, to associational injuries. So the basic gist of their arguments appears to be that their members fear, or the voter assisters fear, a hypothetical future prosecution. Our position is that that's not a certainly impending injury within the scope, within the meaning of Clapper, within the meaning of this court's decision in Texas State LULAC.
But don't we look to, at least in part, to the activities in which they have historically been engaged and activities in which they wish to be engaged in the future? Or is that all irrelevant?
Well, I think it depends on what activities you're talking about, but it seems to me that the claims...
You know which activities the claim.
If you're talking about canvassing and get-out-the-vote efforts and things like that, that's certainly things they engage in. But as I understand their arguments in their briefing, and as I understand the district court's order, the real nub of the injury in fact here is the fear of future prosecution. Because as I understand it, as it's evolved over the briefing, their argument really is these provisions deter voter assisters from coming out to provide assistance because they fear that they might be prosecuted for various reasons. Our view is that that is just simply not a certainly impending injury. There's not a certainly impending prosecution here. It depends on a hypothetical chain of speculation. I mean, the canonical...
I get that argument, but to follow up on what Judge Smith said, don't some of these organizations compensate staffers for assisting voters?
So I think you're talking about 6.06.
Yeah, 6.06.
6.06, yeah. So on 6.06, we're not challenging injury, we're challenging retraceability.
All right.
So as for injury, that's associational injury. There's the canonical example I'll just briefly touch on is Ms. Halverson testified that one of her assisters told her that she was too scared to provide assistance because she thought she might be rung up for perjury and lose her green card. There's way too many chains of speculation in that chain to satisfy the standing injury. So the other bucket of injuries, not voter assister fears, is some of the witnesses testified, well, I just didn't ask because I was scared that the assister would be prosecuted. Ms. Nunez-Landry is a good example of this. She actually testified, I didn't ask my partner for assistance because I didn't want to put him in legal jeopardy, but you know what, if I did ask him, he probably would have helped. So that's, we think, self-inflicted. I'll turn to organizational injury. We think FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine sort of takes care of that. I see their two arguments being, one, diversion of resources, which is the Supreme Court really cut back on that. The court said, unanimous court, Justice Kavanaugh said, an organization can't spend its way into standing simply by expending money to gather information and advocate. That's what we view their claims as here. And then there's another flavor of that organizational injury where they say well, this somehow impairs our efforts to go get out and vote because it depresses the turnout. Well, the Supreme Court said an argument that a law has impaired an organization's ability to provide services and achieve their organizational mission does not work to demonstrate standing. So we think those are the two injury in fact problems they have for most of these provisions.
Remind me, what's your traceability argument with respect to 6.06?
So 6.06, that's a criminal law provision. Our view is that the Attorney General does not prosecute election law crimes after Stevens, and so it's not traceable to him. It's traceable, if at all, to a district attorney, but not the Attorney General. I will go now to the merits on 202, and our basic point is that 208 does not preempt the six voter assistance provisions of SB1. It, again, as I said at the top, it grants blind, disabled, and illiterate voters the right to voting assistance by a person of their choice, but not any person under any conditions at any time. There's nothing in the text of Section 208 that exempts voter assisters from following these basic procedural rules. They point to the word A, and they say sometimes A means any. We've cited you cases in our brief that suggest it doesn't. If it does, it would depend on context, and there's nothing in the context of Section 208 here that suggests that it was intended to cover it was supposed to give them the right to assistance from anyone at any time.
Can you imagine a state voter assistance provision that would be preempted by 208? Can you give me an example?
Yeah, sure. I mean, imagine a provision that said you can have voter assistance, but you can only get a person that's within a mile of your house. That probably would violate Section 208. It would probably restrict the class of people so narrowly that it would functionally be the state essentially choosing the voter assister. And that's really, I think, what's going on in 208. So 208 was designed to prevent the state from saying, you have to use our election workers or poll workers for assistance. If you've got something that starts to look like that, then I think you run up towards a violation of 208. But as Judge Smith was suggesting, there's nothing like that in these provisions that restrict any class of voters from providing assistance. The testimony really is the voter assister said, well, I'm just unsure about maybe some of these provisions. I'm worried about perjury. I'm worried about these provisions. I'm not going to do it. That does get back to our standing arguments about self-inflicted injury and about the hypothetical chain of causation. But for purposes of 208, we think it doesn't establish a violation. Now, to the extent there's any doubt about the scope of Section 208, and I don't think this court really needs to delineate in this case about a preemption claim, the meets and bounds of Section 208. If you have some questions about, well, what's really the reach of it, I think the presumption against preemption comes in to cure that here and works in our favor. The other thing is their position and the district court's analysis here really seems to have no limiting principle. I mean, their theory is anything that could subjectively deter or discourage a voter assister from providing assistance is preempted by Section 208. Respectfully, that theory appears nowhere in the text of the statute. And if taken to its logical conclusion, you could imagine a voter assister that works late and says, I'd love to give you assistance, but I can't do it because I work till 9 p.m. or something, and the polls by statute generally close at 7. Under their theory, it seems to me that would be a violation of Section 208. Same for maybe a location-based one. What if a voter assister says, well, I'd love to come help you out, but the polling place is too far away. Maybe if the state had another polling place or multiple polling places, that would help. So it's the absurdity canon, I think, shows that it can't be given that sort of maximalist interpretation that they're positing here. I mentioned briefly in my top side, in my opening, the lack of a cause of action. I do want to hit that very briefly. There's somewhat of an oddity here. You have a lot of organizations bringing these claims. Many of them, most of them, are asserting organizational injuries to the organization themselves. But the statute here creates rights, if at all, in voters. So it's somewhat of a mismatch here. I can understand the argument if they're bringing an association, a claim on behalf of their members, and then we could talk about that. But for many of them that are simply bringing these claims on behalf of the organizations themselves, well, the statute creates rights in voters, not the organizations who provide assistance. Maybe they could have another claim under the First Amendment or something like that, but a Section 208 claim, and this is a Section 208 case, it's a real mismatch, and I don't see them having a cause of action. If they are asserting the injuries of their members, they point to Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act. We've had the arguments in our brief for you that doesn't create a cause of action It allows the court to appoint federal observers and suspend the use of devices and tests if an aggrieved person or the AG brings a suit. It doesn't create a cause of action. It presupposes one. I see that I'm running down quickly, so unless there are any further questions, I'll see you at rebuttal.
You've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Cole. Thank you. Mr. Gore?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. John Gore for the intervener appellants. The court should reverse for two reasons. First, plaintiffs lack standing to challenge the oath provision and the disclosure provisions because they failed to link their alleged injuries from those provisions in the causal chain. And second, the plaintiffs bore a high burden to show preemption here, and they failed to carry that burden. There's no exceedingly clear language in Section 208 that Congress sought to displace the federal-state balance of authority when it comes to generally applicable assistance regulations. There's no clear and manifest purpose by Congress to effect that preemptive result. Instead, Congress enacted Section 208 for a critical but cabin purpose, to regulate who may give voters assistance. In particular, Congress sought only to prevent states from forcing voters to use state-approved individuals as assisters. The challenged SB 1 provisions, however, do no such thing. They do not restrict in any way who a voter may choose as an assister. They instead place generally applicable regulations on how all individuals may provide assistance. And those neutral rules do not even implicate, let alone violate, Section 208. The district court's erroneous conclusion otherwise would imperil broad swaths of common sense election laws all across the country, in direct contradiction of Congress's intent and states' authority to set the rules of elections. So the court should reverse. On standing, let me just briefly address, we agree with the state on the traceability analysis. The fundamental problem here with respect to many of the plaintiff's claims is that they didn't link their alleged injuries to the challenged SB 1 provisions. This case is on all fours with this court's prior decision in Texas State LULAC. In Texas State LULAC, a group of plaintiffs, including LULAC, which is one of the plaintiffs here, challenged a Texas voter registration statute. They claimed they were trying to comply with that statute, but that the scope and applicability of that statute was unclear and uncertain. They said, therefore, that they experienced a subjective chill because of a fear of future prosecution. And this court rejected that particular theory of standing in that case. The court held that any resulting subjective chill was insufficient to create standing because any risk of future prosecution was too speculative. And here the plaintiff's claims on their subjective chill argument fall apart for exactly the same reason. They allege they want to comply with these SB 1 provisions. They're not alleging they want to violate them. They say they want to comply, but they say that the provisions are unclear or uncertain. It's far too speculative that there'd be any risk of future prosecution based upon their good faith efforts to provide voter assistance. They'd first have to intentionally or knowingly violate these SB 1 provisions. All of these provisions have robust scienter requirements. They say they're not going to do that. So they'd have to contradict themselves and intentionally or knowingly violate those provisions. They'd also then have to, those violations would have to be detected. They'd have to be reported, they'd have to be investigated, and they'd have to be prosecuted.
All you need is an aggressive or ambitious DA in any one of 254 counties, right?
I respectfully disagree with that because, first of all, I don't think we can presume that DAs will act in that fashion. There's no evidence in the record to support that. There's no evidence in the record that anyone has ever been prosecuted under these provisions. And these laws have been on the books now for a few years. So I don't think there's any basis to draw an inference that an aggressive DA or some other state official is going to unreasonably enforce these particular requirements. And it would be particularly bizarre to do so with respect to voter assistance, where the state has now repeatedly said that good faith efforts to provide voter assistance don't run afoul of these prohibitions. And on organizational standing, we agree with the state.
You don't agree that it has a chilling effect on those who may be willing to serve as assisters when you have a statute which has an oath making it clear that you're subject to state jail felony punishable by up to 2 years in prison for violation of one of the terms or conditions of that oath? You don't think that has a chilling effect on who's willing to be an assister?
I think whether or not there's a chilling effect is only part of the analysis under Texas State LULAC. You have to look at the reason why there is that chilling effect and whether that's sufficient to satisfy Article III's traceability requirement. And here, Texas State LULAC makes clear that a credible fear of future prosecution is an essential link in the causal chain in a subjective chill case. These are not First Amendment cases, but even in a First Amendment case, the plaintiff still has to prove a serious intention to engage in conduct proscribed by the law. We don't have that here.
Well, but if there are no prosecutions because there are people who are afraid to be assisters, then you have the effect of the statute. If you're telling me I need to have evidence that somebody's willing to prosecute, well, they need to have sufficient evidence that there's been a violation of the statute. And if there's no violation because nobody's willing to be an assister because they fear being prosecuted, how are you ever going to get that evidence?
There are still plenty of people who are providing voter assistance in elections in Texas after SB 1. Their assistance has been provided all across the state for numerous voters, and so far there's no evidence of any prosecution. But even if the court decides there is standing here, the claims fail on the merits.
On that point, wasn't there already an oath requirement before SB 1?
Absolutely.
SB 1 just added some lines to it.
It added some lines to it that simply inform the assister of their pre-existing legal obligations, that they're taking the oath under penalty of perjury, and that they didn't pressure or coerce the voter.
You know how far back that oath goes?
I don't know offhand, but a long time.
Is there any evidence of any prosecutions for under the old oath requirement?
Not aware of any such evidence in this record, Your Honor. But turning to the merits, as I mentioned, Section 208 serves a very vital but cabin purpose. It's simply to ensure that voters do not have to select a state-approved individual as their assister. It doesn't preempt any rules regarding how that assistance is given. As I mentioned, there's no exceedingly clear language, there's no clear statement by Congress to do so, and the plain text of the statute doesn't support that either. In fact, the plain text of the statute demonstrates otherwise. It says that a voter is entitled to assistance from a person of their choice, not any person. It also carves out exceptions for the voter's employer and union agents, which underscore that Congress was concerned about who may give assistance, not how that assistance is given. Those exceptions are conceptually different from generally applicable rules regulating voter assisters and the assistance they provide. The other side also points to this court's decision in OCA Greater Houston, but the question was not presented in that case. It wasn't even briefed or argued by the parties. The only question in that case was the definition of to vote within Section 208, not a person. And any ambiguity, if the court believes there is in the statute, should be construed against preemption, both as a matter of the presumption against preemption and principles of constitutional avoidance. I see that I'm out of time. If there are further questions, I'm happy to answer those.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gore. Mr. Nichols?
Good morning, and may it please the court. Continuing the theme for the morning, the issues presented by the Harris County District Attorney don't go to the merits of the plaintiff's claims. They don't go to the merits of the district court's decision on those claims. They go to the issue of whether the Harris County District Attorney belongs here in the first place. And in my time this morning, I just want to answer the court's questions, but also to reinforce what we see as has already been said this morning. Jurisdiction goes first. It's always before this court. And to encourage the panel in reaching a decision in this case to address the important standing issues that are at the heart of the claims against the Harris County District Attorney. Just a brief recap of the overall picture of this litigation.
Well, before you do that.
Yes, sir.
So you're co-counsel said that with respect to 6.06, which is the criminal ban on paid assistance,
yes, sir,
that their argument was there's a traceability problem because the AG and the Secretary of State, I think he said, definitely the AG, doesn't enforce that. But your client enforces that, right?
Has the authority to enforce, okay, criminal laws within the jurisdictional bounds of Harris County. But I'm going to refer the court back to the earlier case in the arc of this whole litigation, which is the Mi Familia Vota case versus Ogg. Right. And in that case, Judge Southwick, speaking for the court, said very clearly, and I'm quoting, there is no, quote, statute that commands the Harris County District Attorney or any other district attorney to prosecute Texas election code violations generally. So that's Judge Duncan, that's our response there, and it loops back to what others have said, I don't want to repeat it, about the standards of standing, the need to show an imminent injury, the way that's developed all the way through Clapper. You know, Clapper was the challenge to FISA. The argument there was we've had to change our behavior because we're concerned about prosecution, and the court in that 5-4 vote said that you haven't shown the requisite level of imminent fear, and that's Judge Graves to answer your question from earlier, which is, you know, well, how do you get these cases to federal court then? I mean, if you've got a situation where no one's been prosecuted, and people feel like they can't take certain actions because they might get prosecuted, that's where the argument comes in, which I've addressed in the earlier case before the court. The argument is basically we have to be able to sue somebody, and we ought to, and always in keeping in mind the arc of the litigation, this litigation started not against district attorneys from Texas. It started as litigation against the Secretary of State, the governor of the state, and then post State v. Stevens, that's when the claims against the DAs came in. And from the get-go, we were making the respectful positions on three grounds. Number one, the plaintiffs have raised claims against DAs that really don't concern criminal laws. And the district court here actually cut back on some of those claims, finding that certain of the allegations that plaintiffs made didn't really concern criminal laws, so obviously nothing to see there. Then we came up to this court in Mi Familia Vota v. Ogg, and that's on the issues of Ex Parte Young. This court declared that with respect to all the constitutional claims, that those could not be advanced here against the Harris County DA, and by extension any other DA, because of that a similar issue, which is that they're just saying that the district attorney has the authority to prosecute cases doesn't mean that you can actually show, as in Ex Parte Young itself, where the state AG wrote a letter to the railroad saying, I'm gonna enforce this law against you. In the absence of evidence, as my colleagues have said already, of any kind of enforcement action like that, you can't get around Ex Parte Young. So the constitutional claims are gone. Now we're coming down in the funnel, and there are basically four claims that are still pending that are the subject of the district court's October 2024 ruling on 208. And our respectful position is that there is no, in the ever-increasing height of proof that's required under our country's standing cases, Article III cases, there is no proof to establish that these, any one of these plaintiffs have a basis on which to assert standing against the Harris County District Attorney. And all of that is laid out in our briefing, and in reflecting on what Judge Smith has said a couple of times today, I learned from my first mentor, a federal judge in Houston, who was a colleague in the Bob Casey Courthouse to Judge Smith, I learned that early on that if you want to be in federal court, you have to show that you belong there. And so we've gone through this process of kind of working through these claims, eliminating those that don't concern criminal laws, then eliminating those that there's no sovereign immunity would bar with no exception for those under Ex parte Young. And now we're down to these last four. Judge Duncan, you mentioned one. These are claims that relate roughly to the oath that was also discussed, relate to voter assistance in the mail-in ballot process with respect to these affirmations that I think you mentioned also. There is the compensation provision with respect to compensating those who assist voters. And then there's the one with respect to vote harvesting. And with respect to each and every one of those claims, our respectful position is that there is no Article III jurisdiction for the court to have entered any relief against the Harris County District Attorney. And we also have what you may view as being very arcane arguments about the way the Texas criminal justice system works, but as someone who's worked in the criminal justice system in Texas for between 30 and 40 years, we also commend those technical concerns that we have with the district court's ruling to the court's attention. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Nichols. Ms. Perales?
Good morning, and may it please the court. Nina Perales for Lupe Apeliz. The plain text of Section 208, binding precedent, and an unchallenged fact record require affirmance here. The state's witnesses testified that the following are felonies under SB 1. An elderly voter brings her mail ballot to a social services organization for help from people she knows and trusts who are on the organization's staff, and they help. A blind voter buys lunch for a friend in exchange for help completing his mail ballot. A disabled voter pays the high schooler who lives next door $20 to help him complete his mail ballot.
These are hypotheticals?
No, Your Honor. These are testimony from the state's witnesses.
Wait. These things actually happened, or they're hypotheticals?
They were testimony of the state witnesses that those scenarios, Your Honor, so hypothetical in that
they're sense, hypotheticals.
Would violate the statute.
Mm-hmm.
Section 208 is a short and specific federal statute. Blind, disabled, and low-literate voters have the right to vote with the assistance of a person of their choice, with four exceptions. 208's creation of the right to assistance and the four exceptions means that the state cannot add more categories of people who are prohibited from assisting. Judge Smith, you asked earlier whether there were any categorical exclusions. The answer is yes in 6.06. The ruling on...
No, 6.06, you can still assist a voter, you just can't be paid to do it.
So
the person, if I say I want you to assist me, and the person can do that as long as that person's not paid.
That's a categorical exclusion, Your Honor. The category of persons who receive anything of economic value are excluded from assisting. We believe this is very similar to the court's ruling in OCA Greater Houston in 2017. In that case, Texas had a law that barred assistance from individuals who lived in a different county. They were registered to vote in a different county than the voter in question. Here we have that same type of categorical exclusion where the state says, well, before we were told it was suspicious to have help from someone who lived in a different county. So we excluded them, but we were told that that was preempted. Now we've decided another group of people are suspicious. Those are people who receive anything of economic value, even a lunch, even $20, or even, and this is regardless of the type of assistance that they offer, even if it's in perfect faithfulness to the voters' interests, as long as they accept that one thing of value, they either work for an organization, they get the lunch, they get the $20, that they're categorically excluded
from helping. What if the state said, people who have been convicted of felony respecting a voter intimidation cannot assist?
Understanding that those are not the facts of this case, Your Honor. I believe it is a hypothetical, Your Honor. I'm going to try not to fight it. The answer would be that the state is allowed to have rules and regulations about what unlawful assistance is, you know, what coercion is, but the state cannot layer on categories of individuals that impair the voter's choice. So the answer would be that that is taken care of with laws that criminalize coercion or marking the ballot differently, the existing laws that we have marking the ballot differently than the voter's choice.
What about if the state statute prohibited assistance from a person who is intoxicated at the time that person is rendering the assistance? Would be a categorical exclusion?
Your Honor, at that point, you know, it's been our reading of 208 that the assister has to be willing and able. And I think that hypothetical raises the question whether the assister is able to deliver assistance. So I don't know the answer to that, but I know that it's possibly not a categorical exclusion. I'd like to move on now to the parts of SB. So I'd like to move on from 6.06 and 7.04, which we contend are both categorical exclusions, to the provisions known as the disclosure requirements and the oath. There, the state is not categorically excluding an assister, but is imposing obstacles to voting with assistance and frustrating the voter's ability to vote with an assister. And for that reason, it is also conflict preempted. I'd like to point out that the oath forces the voter to make a representation of eligibility. SB 1 conditions your ability to exercise your right under 208 on making a representation that you're eligible, whether the voter wants to make that representation or not, and then places the assister into a really impossible trap with the oath, because the assister has to say that they obtained a statement of eligibility. The assister also has to acknowledge at the end of the oath that if the assister gives help to a voter who is not eligible, the ballot will not be counted. There's also no guidance in the oath about what eligibility is. And so the testimony in the case shows that assisters are caught between trying to ensure that the ballot will be counted, trying to ensure they don't commit the crime of unlawful assistance, but asking and trying to get a statement of eligibility. Assisters either have the choice to inquire further into eligibility or just not assist. And what the record shows is that assisters have not been assisting. As one personal attendant of a disabled voter testified in this case, the burden falls on the attendant to make sure they get it right. And this is more than what we've signed up for.
Ms. Perales, there was a previous oath, right? So the district court helpfully provided a red line of that in its opinion. In the previous oath, it's you're required to swear or affirm, I am not the voter's employer, an agent of the voter's employer. I will prepare the voter's ballot as the voter directs. So you had to swear to all those things. In your view, was that prior oath preempted by 208?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
So even if a voter, even if an assister said, you know, I just don't feel comfortable swearing to this because, you know, it might come out later that I didn't prepare the ballot, I could get in trouble, I'm swearing. It didn't say under penalty of perjury, but of course it was understood in the law to be under penalty of perjury. That wouldn't also be a preempted by 208 problem?
That's not what we're arguing here. In fact, the pre-existing oath, which has been around for a long time, and the disclosures that go with it also require your name and your address and whether you're being compensated by a campaign or a PAC. We haven't challenged any of those things because those things don't cross the line in the way that the statement of eligibility being required from the voter, and also the disclosure of relationship being required as well. They are on the other side of the line, Your Honor, because they deter assisters. Anybody challenging any other part of the oath would have to come to court and would have to prove that these things are in fact frustrating or impeding the right to vote with assistance as guaranteed by 208. I mentioned about the relationship disclosure as opposed to disclosing one's name and address. And the singling out of the relationship is based, according to the state and its testimony at trial, on the understanding that if you're getting help from a relative, that's normal, that's legitimate. But if you're not getting help from a relative, that is information they want to know so that they can investigate it as possible fraud.
I mean, I guess you can put, people can put constructions on whatever they want, but this is a preemption case. So why shouldn't I just look at this disclosure and say, well, look, I can get this person to assist me. They just have to disclose that they're my uncle or they're not related to me. Those two things can exist in perfect harmony. How is a disclosure requirement preempted? It's a preemption case. It's not like a First Amendment case. It's a preemption.
The extensive evidence at trial and the unchallenged findings of the court are that that relationship disclosure, as well as the oath, deter assisters and frustrate and create an obstacle to the exercise of the right under Section 208. Frustrating and presenting obstacles is a form of conflict preemption, unlike the impossibility.
To be clear, the disclosure is I'm not related to the person I'm assisting.
No, it is the relationship disclosure. So whatever it is that you are.
What if you're not related?
Sorry?
What do you have to disclose if you're not a family member?
It would be to the assister's understanding of what needed to be disclosed. Maybe one assister would write one thing, another assister would write another, but what they're definitely doing is putting down that they're not a family member. And in light of the state's interpretation of the statute, that this is not normal, those are the words used, not legitimate assistance, assisters have good reason to fear that by putting down a relationship that is not a familial relationship, it is going to expose them to prosecution. And this is why assisters have not been assisting, according to the evidence.
You're not challenging a disclosure, say, I am not the employer of the person I'm assisting?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. But so that's okay. I'm not the employer. I have to disclose that. I have to write somewhere, I am not the employer. So that's okay. But I am not a family member is preempted.
That is what the evidence in the case shows, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And those facts are not contested.
Okay.
I would like to say that defendants have created a very small interpretation of the scope of 208. The example given by my friend, Mr. Cole, is that it might be preempted to say that you can only be assisted by somebody from within a mile, and that the whole point of this statute is so that the state cannot designate the assister. But that's not what 208 says. 208 doesn't ban or prohibit states from designating assisters. In fact, it does the complete opposite. It says that the voter has the right to vote with the assistance of a person of their choice. And that is, of course, much broader than simply restraining states from designating who the assister will be. The text and structure of the act is to make sure that states do not place obstacles in the way. And the even when you go into the legislative history, you see that same intent. And so for all of those reasons, respectfully, we urge affirmance. Thank you.
So I want to hear from one of the appellees regarding Mr. Nichols' presentation regarding the Harris County District Attorney. Is someone going to address that as far as you know, or if not, I can give you a minute to address it. But.
Your Honor, Mr. Dalling is going to address that question. His plaintiff group
okay, that's fine.
As a defendant, yeah. The Harris County District Attorney.
All right, that'll be good. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to let you pronounce your last name because I'm sure to mess it up. So.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Victor Jennison.
Jennison.
Yes.
All right, Mr. Jennison.
And I am here this morning, may it please the court, to argue for the appellees Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, the Ark of Texas, and Mi Familia Vota. And my clients challenge the assister oath and assister disclosure provisions of SB 1. That's sections 603 to 605 and 607. And those provisions, as the district court found, operate together as a single requirement that obstructs the purpose of section 208 because it disfavors assisters from community service organizations like my clients that provide direct assistance to voters and thereby reduces the pool of available assisters. The district court further found, Your Honors, that the challenge provisions deter people who assisted voters in the past, before SB 1 was passed, from assisting them now, and that they chill voters who need assistance from obtaining help from their assisters of choice. And Your Honor, this court decided OCA, Greater Houston, and Robinson versus Ardoin, and those cases resolve 4 out of 5 of the issues that are raised by the appellants in this appeal. Those cases decide that Section 208 abrogates state sovereign immunity. Having determined the question of sovereign immunity, OCA, as Robinson versus Ardoin teaches, has done most of the work necessary to conclude that Section 208 affords a private right of action because Congress abrogates sovereign immunity in order to allow the states to be sued by someone. OCA does not address associational standing, which the ARC clearly has. Its disabled members are directly impacted by the challenge provisions. But OCA does, in detail, address organizational standing. And it sets forth the bases on which Delta Sigma Theta and the ARC and Mi Familia Vota have standing. They are, and we've heard a fair amount about Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, but in fact, these appellees are direct service organizations, unlike the lobbying organization in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, and like the direct service organization in Havens Realty, which is cited in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine to contrast between a pure lobbying organization and an organization that provides direct services. And I submit that the reasoning of OCA, although OCA does not directly cite Havens Realty, the reasoning of OCA is congruent with the reasoning set forth in Havens Realty. These organizations now are required to perform additional work, as OCA put it, to mitigate what it called the real-world impact of the challenge provisions on their members and the public. And the oath and the assister disclosures regulate these organizations' activities by requiring volunteers or employees to take actions that they didn't have to take before SB 1 was passed.
They had to take an oath before.
They did, Your Honor. And
so just the addition of lines creates the standing?
Well, Your Honor,
the pre-existing oath?
It's not just the addition of lines. It's the lines specifically that were added.
Okay.
The oath certainly was always subject, in fact, to penalties of perjury.
Okay, so it can't be that one.
But the oath now includes vague and undefined terms, eligibility and pressure or coerce. And the assister is now determined to attest that statements are true when the assister can't know what those terms mean. And the terms of the oath do not incorporate the knowing or intentional falsity and intent to deceive that are elements of perjury under state law. And without any reference to those scienter requirements, without saying I...
Wait, by referencing penalty of perjury, it's not referencing the scienter requirements of perjury?
Well, by saying penalty of perjury, Your Honor, but without explaining, or to be more precise, without including the language that is necessary to establish perjury.
So the oath would have to say, I swear or affirm under penalty of perjury, comma, which is subject to scienter requirements under Texas criminal law?
Well, that which is, okay. I would suggest that subject to, the oath would need to state those scienter requirements, which are knowing or intentional falsity and intent to deceive. So I swear or affirm that I know and intend, do not intend to deceive, etc., so that it's clear what the person who's swearing is swearing to. And without that
previous oath you just said is implicitly subject to perjury penalties.
Yes.
The previous oath.
Previously, yes, it was.
Now the oath specifically says under penalty of perjury, but in your view it is misleading because it doesn't go on to spell out the knowledge requirements.
And that, Your Honor, is because simply the addition of the words under penalty of perjury are frightening as voters, assisters, and Texas election officials testified. There we have not just a theoretical basis for saying this, there is a record basis that the district court credited that the penalty of perjury language is intimidating and threatening, and I would suggest, Your Honor.
Shouldn't it be? When someone swears an oath, shouldn't they be somewhat concerned about whether they're swearing truthfully?
Yes, but the words under penalty of perjury, Your Honor, those words are not a disclosure. Where nothing in the words explains the intent requirement, the purpose of the phrase is in terrorem. It doesn't inform, it inhibits, and we know this because we have extensive testimony about it, and those words, the addition of those words, is combined with the addition of further words. The word eligibility is not defined, and as the district court found, the use of the undefined term eligibility puts voters and puts assisters in the position of having to figure out what that means. And understandably, without a definition, they don't know. Even ballots that are voted in accordance with the voter's wishes may be voided if the voter received unauthorized assistance under the terms of the oath. So the possibility that an otherwise valid...
Is that not true of the prior oath? If you swore falsely under the prior oath, would the voter's ballot be counted?
The prior oath did not require assisters to determine or voters to establish eligibility.
Mm-hmm. I know that. If the under the prior oath the person swore falsely, would the voter's ballot be counted?
If the assister violated the terms of the prior oath, which, Your Honor, are consistent with the permissions and prohibitions of Section 208, while the new requirements are not. That's really our...
I'm asking if you swore falsely under the prior oath, would the ballot be counted? Would the ballot be counted if you swore falsely under the prior oath?
Well, the voters, the legitimacy of the voters' vote was not called into question.
Well,
in the way that it is.
The prior oath, which I just read, said, I swear that I, you know, abided by the voters' preferences.
Yes.
Right, obviously. And so if you swore falsely to that, turns out you didn't abide by the voters' preferences, would the ballot be counted?
And certainly it would not be counted.
Okay, so.
Yeah, certainly.
So no.
I should emphasize that, as the district court found, an assister must take the oath and complete the disclosure form for each voter that she assists, but the poll workers are not required to take the oath or to complete the disclosure form. Mm-hmm. So voters who choose their assisters must establish their eligibility for assistance, while those who vote with the help of poll workers need only ask, right? And voters who vote with the help of their chosen assisters are subject to that threat in the oath that their vote will be voided if they're not eligible, while no such threat hangs over voters who obtain the help of poll workers. And OCA holds that a voter's right to assistance continues during the counting process. So this is a threat against the ability of the voter to have their vote count. And in argument, just a few minutes ago, Mr. Cole made...
You have to swear, I did not pressure or coerce the voter into choosing me to provide assistance. That protects the voter. Doesn't that protect the voter? For the assister to swear, I'm not telling the voter how to vote, I'm swearing that I don't do that.
Well, neither pressure, the terms pressure nor coerce are defined in the statute. There is no scienter requirement. The terms require an assister to accurately judge the actual consequences of the assister's conduct on another person's state of mind, right, against these undefined terms. And I would suggest that there's an 11th Circuit case, League of Women Voters versus Florida Secretary of State, in which that court struck down a Florida statute that prohibited activity with the effect of influencing the voter.
Is your position that the prior oath was also preempted by Section 208?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, the prior oath said, I will prepare the voter's ballot as the voter directs. Now, why doesn't that put the assister in the same position? I have to swear that I did that. What if I didn't do it? I'm afraid that maybe I didn't do it. Maybe there was some miscommunication.
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that that is a more hypothetical fear than any of the fears that were established on this record in this case. Now, I see...
Yeah, you were going to respond to something that Mr. Cole had said, so you can go ahead and take 1 minute if you'd like to do that.
Thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Cole said that Section 208 prohibits or would prohibit a law that says you must use the state's poll workers. And in fact, as the district court found, an assister has to complete the oath of assistance on the disclosure form while the poll worker does not. So voters who choose their own assisters are required to establish eligibility for assistance, while poll workers are required not to ask the voter for representation of eligibility. And the voters that poll workers help are presumed to be eligible for assistance. And assisters must wait in line to swear the oath for each voter they assist, which lengthens the time that disabled voters must wait before they can vote with assistance. And all of these provisions push voters to choose poll workers over their own assisters of choice, and that choice comes with a price, because when a voter receives assistance from a poll worker, Texas law permits partisan poll watchers to be present at the voting station and to examine the ballot before it's deposited into the ballot
box. Seems like the natural sort of consequence of your argument is that any oath provision would be preempted by 208. 208 doesn't say a person of the voter's choice who has sworn not to coerce their vote, right? So why could a state ever impose an oath requirement on an assister? Any oath requirement?
Your Honor, 208, I would submit, strikes the balance between the risk of intimidation, the risk of coercion, the risk of fraud, and the unfettered choice of the voter. And
wouldn't the consequence of your argument mean that under 208, a state could never have an oath requirement for an assistor? 208 doesn't say person who's sworn something, right?
Well, Your Honor, 208 does not prohibit the oath in the prior form in which it existed before SB1. And it doesn't because all that that oath does is remind the assister of his duty to faithfully reproduce the voter's choices in the ballot, and it causes the assister to swear that he is not in either of the prohibited categories that Section 208 describes. Here, by contrast, we have a whole lot of additional material that the voter is required to swear to that are not part of 208. Your Honors, I would like to leave you with the remark that 208 was enacted to ensure full participation of all Americans in our democracy, and there are 3 million voting eligible Texans who have disabilities, that veterans are more likely to have a disability than our non-veterans, that fully a fifth of voters with disabilities are in the category that is disfavored by SB1, that is, they receive assistance from people who are not their family members, and disability is highly correlated with age. As we get older, we all may fall in to the categories that are protected by 208.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jennison.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Dolling?
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Zachary Dolling, and I represent the OCA plaintiffs, OCA Greater Houston, and the League of Women Voters of Texas. The OCA plaintiffs brought challenges only to Section 6.06, which bans compensated mail voting assistance, against the Secretary, the AG, and the Harris County DA. We adopted the Lupe plaintiffs' briefing against the Secretary and the AG, but are unique in our claim against the DA. And so I wanted to use our time to respond to several of the points raised by counsel for the DA. Before I get to that, though, I did want to point out that evidence at trial showed that the AG is prosecuting, after the CCA's decision in Stevens, cases of unlawful assistance and illegal voting, that the AG is investigating alleged violations of Section 6.03 and 7.04, and that the SOS is investigating and referring unlawful assistance and illegal voting cases. Just wanted to put that out there.
You're saying the AG is violating the CCA's decision in Stevens?
No, the AG is not unilaterally prosecuting any cases, but the record does reflect that they work collaboratively with local prosecutors through a variety of processes. That said, I'd like to respond to the several points raised by counsel for the DA and also describe one additional affirmative ground for standing that the OCA plaintiffs have. So first, the OCA plaintiffs and their members face a credible threat of prosecution by the DA, even if no prosecutions have yet been brought. And second, Section 6.06 forbids and thus directly interferes with the OCA plaintiff's core activity of providing mail ballot assistance. So I'll start with injury based on a threat of prosecution. The test to show such injury has three requirements, only one of which the DA truly takes issue with, which is showing that there's a credible threat of prosecution. But that's not surprising, given the record-based fact that the statute has proven, the fact that the DA has not yet brought a prosecution under this law is not surprising, given the record-based fact that the statute has proven to be a powerful and effective deterrent, which was a point that Judge Graves was getting at earlier. Rather, the credible threat inquiry is case and fact specific. It does not require that the OCA plaintiff show that the statute has ever been applied where, as here, other factors support a credible threat of prosecution.
Let me just ask you, if your client's members keep doing exactly what they have been doing, are they running afoul of 6.06?
If they were to continue doing what they had done previously, yes.
Okay.
OCA Greater Houston has paid staffers whose duties previously included providing mail ballot assistance. Okay.
You're an object of the...
Yes, an object of the... And I think that is the simplest route for standing, but in an abundance of caution, we are also discussing other routes. Mr. Nichols raised the fact that this court previously in Mi Familia Vota, the AUG, noted that there is no mandatory duty for him to, or for the DA to prosecute cases, but I think that this court's precedents make clear that prosecutorial discretion is always in play. That doesn't simply defeat a threat of prosecution standing. One factor is the DA has refused to fully disavow prosecution in this case, and there is a Texas law that became effective in the middle of this case in September 2023 that makes it so that he cannot disavow prosecution without risking removal.
You mentioned some prosecutions, the Attorney General in collaboration with local district attorneys. Is that at the instigation of the Attorney General? Or is it at the instigation of the local district attorney? In other words, who says I want to work with who?
I think typically it goes from the AG to the DA, but the record does reflect both instances. And so chief among these factors is the refusal to disavow. Second, the Texas Election Code does require the DA to investigate certain reports when two or more voters report a crime. And this sort of broad universe of complainants who can generate or force an investigation that extends to private citizens has also been found to be a factor that increases the credible threat of enforcement. Also, this law is less than 5 years old. It's recently passed, and I think the court should assume that the Texas legislature passes laws intending them to be enforced.
So if we were to rule that SB1 is preempted, then why isn't that the end of the ball game? In other words, why does there have to be any separate involvement with any district attorney as a separate party? It seems, if not downright improper, at least redundant, because the underlying question is whether SB1 is preempted. Unless I misunderstand the underlying nature of the suit.
Well, Your Honor, I think you are correct that if this court upholds the district court's injunction as against the state of Texas, which was a party to this suit, then that would bind the local prosecutors and it would be redundant to have them as defendants. But I think also, we're trying to cover all our bases. We want to name every defendant who has a personal, plays a role in enforcing the law to make sure that we cover all.
Well, you need standing, right? And so there'd have to be a traceability to somebody who's enforcing the law.
Correct.
An injunction would have to run against DA, right? Unless we decided the AG and the SOS are also enforcing.
Well, our position is that the district court got the injunction right in that because the state of Texas is properly a defendant here, because the VRA does abrogate sovereign immunity, that the And as the Texas Constitution, the Court of Criminal Appeals decisions, Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, all things the district court relied upon in determining that when local prosecutors are enforcing statewide laws, wielding state authority, they are representing the state.
Okay.
And so an injunction against the state would run against the DAs. And I see I'm out of time, so if there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Dolly.
Thank you, Your Honors.
So we've run a little bit over time on some of the presentations, so Mr. Cole will have 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Smith. Just want to make a couple points on merits and jurisdiction, but before I do, I want to make one overarching point, and that is, I think, Judge Duncan, you hit the nail on the head at the beginning of the bottom side argument where you said the word hypothetical. That's what most of this is. Hypothetical fears, hypothetical, hypothesized interpretations of the law. And one interesting thing that I took note of during the topside argument is what you're hearing is arguments from organizations saying our voter assisters are somehow impeded, are scared. and they're bringing suit under a statute that creates rights for any voter. It doesn't say voter assisters have the right to give assistance. It says a voter has the right to assistance. So if they want to bring a First Amendment claim or something like that, that's fine. But I would note again for the court the oddity of them. It seems like they're just going all in on the organizational injury point, and I'm happy to address that when I get to jurisdiction, but it is an oddity here that that's what you keep hearing.
But as a practical matter, and I understand that we decide law, not practicality, but as a practical matter, they are being restrained in what they ordinarily do or would like to do. SB 1 does place additional restraints on them.
So a couple responses on that, Judge Smith. The first is this is a Section 208 case, and so it doesn't create rights for them. They may have another claim under the First Amendment. The second thing is, and this is the first point on the merits, is I think they are vastly misunderstanding the scope of several of these provisions. I'll turn to Section 606. So Section 606 does not prevent Get Out the Vote organizations from providing voter assistance. First of all, it exempts family members. It exempts personal caregivers known to the assister. And the statute prevents, what it prevents is our view, is that it prevents this transactional exchange. I'm giving you the assistance in exchange for money or some compensation. It doesn't prevent somebody who's an employee of an organization from giving that. And I think where they're getting that is from the testimony of Jonathan White, and that I have the pages for you here. It's ROA 42795-96. The district court cites this.
Say that page again.
I'm sorry. It's 42795-796. They point to a testimony, a hypothesized one, where, well, what if there's an employee of an organization who's specifically paid to do this? And he said, well, yeah, it might appear to violate that. But just the page up on 795, he says, well, it doesn't prevent the Get Out the Vote organization staffers from doing this. So we think they've vastly overinterpreted the scope of what Section 606 does. 6.04, you heard some testimony about the oath, where they said, well, it requires this statement.
When you think GOTV staffers of a campaign, is that, what just staffers are you talking about?
The staffers of the organizations here before you. So someone that works for the organization that's just paid by the organization for whatever their position might be. They're not.
But they can continue to do that.
That's our view of the statute. Yeah. What 606 is preventing is an actual transactional exchange. If you're specifically paid to go do the voter assistance, that's what it's targeting. Not just anybody who.
Now they can't do that. You're confusing me.
Sorry. If you have an employee of the organization who is specifically paid for that particular activity, if you had facts like
right,
that.
I got that.
Yeah.
They can or can't do it.
They can't do that. But we don't have anyone in the organization that the record reflects is specifically paid for that. They might be have some other position, but not that one. 604, I was just mentioning the oath requirement. There was testimony they have to make a statement of representation or something like that. We think that's not what it requires. It requires a representation. But I think more to the point about that argument, it seems to incorporate the doctrines of vagueness here. They're not bringing a vagueness claim. And so if they want to bring a vagueness claim, that's fine. They've done it to Section 7.04. It's fully briefed in this court. But so they kind of sneak in this vagueness concept that's just not relevant here. On the disclosure portion, there is no evidence in the record that any voter has not been able to be given assistance because of the disclosure requirements. I mean, the Delta Sigma Theta witnesses testified they weren't aware of that, of any person of their organization who wasn't able to get that assistance because of that. So that fails. And on a broader point about Section 208, Ms. Perales said in her argument that an assister, her view of the statute is that an assister has to be willing and able. Able is an interesting word because it seems like what you have here is assisters that are just not willing to do it. And this turns back into our standing arguments about hypothetical fears of prosecution. I'll go to a couple points on jurisdiction in the time I have remaining. On the point about prosecution, I know Judge Smith, you asked, well, don't we just need, what if it's just an aggressive prosecutor out there? I'd commend to the court's attention Susan B. Anthony List versus Driehaus. at pages 159 to 60 of the Supreme Court's decision. It sort of nicely traces out the development of this doctrine of what about a future fear of prosecution. It starts with Steffel versus Thompson. And in all of those cases, what you had was an actual threat from a prosecutor. You also might have had some kind of conduct that sort of inevitably would lead to violating the statute. That was the Babbitt case. And you don't have that here. It's not just the sort of existence of the law, and maybe someday a prosecutor could get aggressive and do this. There's something more in each of those cases that involves some kind of threatened enforcement, past enforcement, maybe not against that person, could be against somebody else. But you just don't have that here. They seem to go in all in again, like I said, on the organizational standing point. I can do really no better than what Justice Kavanaugh said for the court in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, where he said, an argument that a law has impaired an organization's ability to provide services and achieve their organizational mission does not work to demonstrate standing. That's at 394 of the court's opinion. That seems to be what they're saying here. The other thing is they're saying, well, we have to do more educational advocacy work, but that's exactly what they do anyway. So it's not entirely clear to me how they can say, well, we're injured because we have to do more of what we're already doing. That's not an injury. The last thing I'll mention here is the AG enforcement prong of this. It seems to turn entirely on deputization, and they're saying, well, at some point the AG could be deputized to do this. He's been deputized in the past. Deputization is done by the district attorney, and when an attorney from the Office of the Attorney General is deputized, he's exercising the DA's authority. He's deputized as a local prosecutor. So again, they'd need an injunction.
And that couldn't be done at the request of the Attorney General?
It would still have to be the district attorney who does
that. I understand that, but it could be at the request of the Attorney General.
If the Attorney General asks, you're saying they still have to agree to it. And just take a situation where, well, but
you answered my question.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then I will sit down. We ask you to reverse.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cole. Your case and all of today's cases are under submission, and the court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow.